Everybody, welcome back. It is Monday, March 18th, 2024, and you are listening to episode 183 of the Midnight Film Society podcast. Your host, Damian Sherman. Joining me today is...
Derek Allen McDuff. That's my middle name. I don't know if I've ever revealed it on the podcast before, but there you go.
D-A-M. Damn.
Initials are damn. Yes, exactly. That is correct.
Nice. On today's show, the 2024 Academy Awards have come and gone. On to the 2025 awards season.
With
the
Oscars. Oh, no.
With the
God,
Oscars.
We're done with this. I thought we were done.
With the Oscars in the rear view, we'll get into some movie and TV news, including Batman 2 being delayed, new films by Mr. Ari Aster and PTA, what we've been watching, including Shogun, Driveway Dolls, and Love Lies Bleeding. Right into the show, Midnight Film Society at gmail.com, Bicycle on Threads, and Midnight Film Pod on Instagram. Subscribe on Pocket Cast, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. Tell a friend, family member, or stranger. What's up, man? How we doing?
Good. Tired. Just got off a 9-hour shift.
Ooh-wee.
And now I'm ready to go, ready to record.
Yeah, you can probably hear a little rust in my voice. It's quite light here, so sticking with the midnight ethos of the show itself.
Yeah, we gotta you know keep it accurate.
Exactly. Go with the brand. Yes, quite a few things to talk about here. One of the big things is Mr. Akira Toriyama passed away at the age of 68 this week. It was actually not announced right away on the Wikipedia. It said he passed on March 1st, and I don't believe it was revealed to the world until at least a week later, right?
Yeah, because I remember, I guess I found out about it, yeah, that makes sense, about a week ago, because I was at an overnight, and when my weeb friends told me.
Your weeb friends, yeah. So I take it you are not, you said, so you're claiming that, you're not claiming the weeb as yourself, you're not a weeb yourself.
No, that I did not tell myself, no. I heard about it from someone even nerdier than me, so.
Wow. So you never engaged with any sort of anime, no mangas, no animes, no nothing.
Say
like that.
I like Full Metal Alchemist. I fuck with that, you know.
Yeah.
Dragon Ball might not have been my style, but I respect the man as an artist, you know.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, Dragon Quest.
Yeah.
I think that slime, that little slime guy, iconic. His art style also heavily influenced the art style of the official Pokemon art, which lives deep in my soul and my brain.
Yes.
So I got to respect him for that. He's a, you know, real icon.
He is. Yeah. It's one of those things where, you know, Dragon Ball Z in America was localized and shown on American TV on a thing called Toonami on Cartoon Network. Are you familiar with Toonami?
Oh, yeah, I watched the hell out of some Toonami back in my day.
Back in your day.
In my day. Back in the early aughts.
Yes. Yeah, it was...
the heyday of Toonami.
Yes, I would run home every day from school because I think it started around 5:30. The lineup would switch every once in a while. I know Big O was one of them. I know Yu Yu Hakusho was one of them. Dragon Ball Z obviously was one of them. Cowboy Bebop was one of them. So the lineup changed quite often. There would be some ones that would come in there, like you said, Full Metal. I don't know if that was on there yet. I don't know if that even came out.
I don't
yet.
Think it was. I watched it on Netflix years later.
Yeah. No, I was obsessed with Dragon Ball Z. I played, what was it called? Games that came out back then. It was like part one, part two, part three. Oh my God. I played the shit out of them. I can't remember the name of them. Let me look it up because this is bothering me. Did you play any Dragon Ball games, Dragon Ball Z fighting games?
I played one of the fighting ones. Yeah. Like I said, I'm not a big Dragon Ball guy, but I did love Trunks. Trunks was my fucking boy, and I was of the age when GT was on, Trunks with future Trunks with his sword and his badass purple haircut. I was like, this guy fucks, this guy rocks.
So the games I was trying to think of was Budokai, Dragon Ball Z Budokai 1, 2, and 3. Ah. Obsessed with. My friend's cousin had a PlayStation, a PlayStation 2.
Everybody's cousin had something. Yeah, yes. That's what was up. You'd go to your cousin's house and play some shit. That was it.
The first time I met him, I forget what his name was. I think Melvin or Kevin, Puerto Ricans. That was the thing, too, about Dragon Ball Z. It transcended race. Every black people loved it. Puerto Ricans loved it. White people loved it. Asian people obviously loved it. It was one of those things that everybody just fucked with.
Hispanic people love like that. I saw like a TikTok where yes. It was like Ron yes. Swanson, and it was like Hispanics when he died, and it was just like half mass is too high. And, you know, someone who's got a lot of... lives in Southern California. A lot of my friends are of that community. You know, I can vouch for that 100%.
Yes. Let me see if I was play, because I don't see in the list here, PlayStation game. I went over his house, my friend's cousin's house, and the thing we were battling back and forth, because there's always those modes or those mechanics where you can push the button as fast as you can. And I was the fastest mm-hmm. button pusher in my friend group until I met this guy. And we were just like, we were pretty well matched.
finally, a real challenger.
Yes, exactly. Okay, Dragon Ball Z Ultimate Battle 22 was a 1995 video game. So it was very old, but it had like all of the characters, you know. So we were going back and forth between that. There were Flash games that I was obsessed with. But anyways, I would come home, watch it every day. And you know this, but I'm just telling the people. The sagas would... they would start at like the Saiyan Saga and Raditz Saga. That was the first one of Dragon Ball Z. And it would show that saga. And I think they got up to like... the dragon, what was it called? Not the dragon maze, but the route, the dragon road or spirit road. He went to King Kai's planet. I swear to God, they showed that saga over and over again. Then they get a little bit further, into the Namek saga. They go to the Namek saga. They show that over and over again. So I probably seen all of the Dragon Ball at least 7 times all the way through, just because you get home from school, like I said, and you're like, all right, next time in Dragon Ball Z, if Goku's finally going to get Frieza, going right back to the fucking Raditz Saga. I was like, fuck, another 6 months of this bullshit. But I would do that, and then, you know, just watch all the sagas over and over again. I think I saw the movies a bunch of times. So yeah, suffice to say, Dragon Ball Z was a huge, huge milestone, huge, huge part of my life for a long time, long, long time. So this is a big deal. Yeah. For me.
Yeah. 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 The legend,
Akira Toriyama. He did Dragon Ball Super, which I haven't gotten into, which I believe he did. You know why he did that? Do you know why he made a new series, the newest series called Dragon Ball Super?
Because everyone hated GT. I don't know.
No, GT was actually GT wasn't part of the saga. It wasn't canon. That wasn't Toriyama. Toriyama actually didn't do GT. Oh. And some other people. Yeah. So
that's why everyone hated it, because I know it's like been decanonized.
Yeah, it was decanonized, okay. And they're slowly bringing in characters from that. But Toriyama left. He stopped the series after the Buu saga. The Buu saga was the last one. They did a send off. He was done with it, I believe, in like the early 2000s. And then the America, white folks, made the movie Dragon Ball Evolution. I forget who was in it, but it made a movie called Dragon Ball Evolution, which absolutely tanked. I believe it was around the same time as Mr. Shyamalan's Avatar movie as well.
Yeah, so I know, like, people do not like that movie.
Yeah, no. So Toriyama saw that and saw the reaction of it. He's like, I can't leave Dragon Ball at that point. I can't let that be the last thing in the world of Dragon Ball. So Dragon Ball Z. Mm. So he made a movie. I forget what the movie was called, but he did that. Then wrote, I think, around 200 or 250 more episodes called Dragon Ball Super, which I haven't seen any of it, but it looks incredible. Animation looks incredible. Really cool ideas of, like, you know, Super Saiyan God, Super Saiyan Goku, and not instant transmission. That was a different thing. What's it called? Oh, Ultra Instinct. Ultra Instinct Goku, where he's got fucking blue / gray hair. It was fucking crazy.
I did play one fighting game where I always played Goku Black. He was like, if Goku got possessed by like an evil god or something, he had pink hair. And he gave zero fucks, and he had an earring, and he was like, I don't give a shit. Yeah.
Do you know what the earring was for?
I don't know. Yeah, what was the earring for? Was it superpowers?
If you put on an earring in your left ear, and I put on an earring in my right ear, then we would fuse and become Damianic. Damianic, there we go. Because they would have Vegito. Vegito was obviously Goku and Vegeta. They'd have... what was the other one? Gogeta, I think, was a different version because they had different fusions. They had the fusion dance and then they had the fusion earrings. The fusion dance only lasted 30 minutes, but the earrings could last forever unless they got destroyed, obviously.
Oh.
Oh.
You know, I'm just transporting you back to like middle school when like I would not watch any of these shows and my friends all would, and they would just tell me, well, they put on the earrings. I'd be like, huh? All right, cool, man. Yeah. I was just watching Pokemon, but that sounds cool too.
Yes, yes, yes.
Everybody knows that Dragon Ball has the deepest lore.
Some of the deepest lore. It's not even joking. Yeah, it really does. So yeah. Anyways, rest in peace to Akira Toriyama, one of the greats to do it, one of the best to do it. Yeah. Let's see. Some more sad news. The Batman 2, Matt Reeves's The Batman 2, has been pushed back from 2025, which I think, wasn't that already pushed? I think it was pushed a year already. So now this is another push, unfortunately. We won't see this until, allegedly, October 2026 now.
Yeah, that checks out with all the strikes and everything that's been going on. I'm not super surprised to hear that.
Yeah.
I mean, unfortunate as it is, it's not unexpected.
Yep, and we still have yet to see, mentioned in the article, the Penguin TV spinoff, so that could be part of it. He wants Colin Farrell to be part of it, so maybe they're filming that series was slated to start before part two. Maybe it pivots into part two. Who knows? Could be anything.
Yeah. Who knows? Yep. Who knows?
Yep. Then we also got PTA, news on PTA's next movie, slated to open August 2025, his last one being Licorice Pizza, which got very mixed reviews from people.
Yeah, some people, I mean, it got nominated for Best Picture, but a lot of people didn't like it as well, so.
Yes. Slated to star Leo DiCaprio, I don't believe he's worked with before. We have Sean Penn.
No.
Yeah, a bunch of people I don't believe he's worked with. Sean Penn, Regina Hall, Tina Taylor, Wood Harris. But we have Alana Haim coming back from Licorice Pizza. So yeah, a bunch of new people in this. Be very, very interesting to see what that is.
Yeah, really, you know, that's interesting. You know, I'm a big Leo fan.
Yeah.
I like Paul T.A., PTA typically.
Yeah.
So interested to see what their collaboration would look like.
Yeah, absolutely. Then some more, you know, news for the future. We have The Bear supposedly was renewed for season 4 back to back with season 3, but you know, we can never tell with these things if they're actually going to do that. They could be renewed and not actually do it, but yeah, you know, see, for a show like this, what I really want them to do is have, you know, sort of a game plan in terms of, you know, beginning, middle, and end, because this very much feels like a show that's not meant to, you know, continue into the future. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
And yeah, it's not, it should have a definitive end date, you know?
Yes, absolutely. But yeah, looking forward to season 2 of that pretty soon. Another one, and haven't really heard news of, but it's got to be coming down the pike pretty soon, is The Boys season 5.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's another one that, all these different kind of superhero staples, all these big prestige shows, you know, and curious to see what happens with them with the changing streaming landscape.
Yeah, and it's also with Invincible, I heard a lot of talk about that show coming back and how they they split it up to give people time to digest the events of the first half of the season. It's like, shut the fuck off. I don't even know what happened, but, you know, it's obviously animation issues or budgetary issues or what's up.
Awards consideration, they'll do that a lot of time. But I don't know if it would be really in consideration for awards, but I know that's one reason they do that a lot.
That's possible. Somebody mentioned something that I think is interesting in that they waited to release it until was it Amazon Prime had that tier of you have to pay extra for no ads. So that's something I heard could have been an issue. Could have been part of it.
Yeah, that could be a contributing factor.
Yes, indeed. Speaking of, you know, auteur directors coming out with their new stuff, you know, very early in the project, we have Ari Aster, who's Beau's Afraid, came out last year. It was received, you know, by some people that saw it. It was like, what the fuck was that? But apparently, apparently enough people liked it. Did well enough for A24 to greenlight his next movie called.
I mean, not at the box office, but no. That's why I'm kind of surprised, but I'm glad.
Yeah, exactly. Me too. Me too as well. We have actors set to join, including Joaquin Phoenix back from Beau's Afraid, Pedro Pascal, Emma Stone, Luke Grimes from Yellowstone, Austin Butler, Dietrich O'Connell from Outer Range, and Clifton Collins Jr., who I've seen in a bunch of stuff. If people don't know him, I can look up his face. The one, the one project I always think of Clifton Collins Jr. from is, remember the show or the movie that we talked about on Underrated, Rules of Attraction? He was like the drug dealer in that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that should be cool. Can't wait for that. Probably be a while before we see that as well.
Yeah. I'm glad. I was really ooh, are they going to put Ari Aster in director jail? Because that movie did really bad. But I'm glad to see that, he is a... They're giving him another shot. A24 is always good for stuff like that, so that's good to hear.
They are. And yeah, you're correct. In addition to, being one of the few studios that's putting out interesting work, they also aren't, too quick on the draw. They're very, they know what they're putting out. They know that their stuff isn't going to make a lot of money at the box office, but that's not their modus operandi, as they say. We have Venom 3 titled Venom the Last Dance. This is they're joking about this on the big pick today of that's evocative of obviously the multi-part series on Michael Jordan's last season with the Bulls.
Right. Yeah.
Yep. So photo plot details are under wraps. Some pictures have come out from the production of it. So it obviously is actually coming out. These movies have done very well at the box office.
These things make money.
They really do. The first two earned a combined $1.3 billion at the box office. So these actually do very well, contrary to popular belief.
Yeah, it's because the other things in the Spum universe, the Sony universe of Marvel Pictures, whatever the fuck it is, or Spunk, whatever the fuck it's called, Spunk, do not do the Morbiuses and the Madam Webs.
Yes.
I think that's the only two have not done well. So I think that since Venom is tied to those ones, it gets thought of as doing bad. But people, unlike Morbius and Madam Web, like Venom and want to see movies about him. And Tom Hardy is actually acting instead of just being spiders, I see the future.
Dakota
Johnson, good actress when she tries, and she did not give a fuck in that movie.
No, she didn't. Apparently she got into some trouble for her doing the press tour of just not giving a fuck. It's what do you expect? Come on.
She's sleepwalking through that thing.
Oh yeah. Then I'm just thinking about Venom Spunk right now. So thanks for that image.
You're welcome.
So that concludes our movie and TV news. Let's see. Let's get to some what we've been watching. I watch a bunch of stuff as per usual. My Best Picture marathon continues. I finally saw How Green Was Mavali. This was
how green was it though, Damien? That's the question that the people want to know.
Well, it was in black and white, so I couldn't really tell how green it was.
What the fuck?
This is another sort of people in a town are put out of work because of capitalism. But guys, capitalism clearly isn't the problem, even though it's been the problem so far in many of these movies. But I think I sent you a screenshot of the guy who was like, "You're talking socialism now, unionizing. That's socialism. I won't have that talk in my house, not in this house." Shut the fuck up, old man.
The only thing I know about this movie is I guess I always thought it was some Little House on the Prairie shit or something. I don't know why.
Yeah,
I guess just that title. But all I know about it is this is the movie that beat Citizen Kane.
Yep.
And I've heard some people are if anything was going to beat Citizen Kane, it was this one. Is that accurate, Damien?
No. Citizen Kane is better. Okay. Well, I'm sorry. To speak to your actual point, if there was one going to beat it, I guess. I'm not sure. Let me look up, what is it? Oscars 1942, right?
Well, I think they're saying of the, like, you know, when, like, I see the Oscar rankings of, oh, like, this off. One is always towards the top of the list. And they're they're like, you know, it was like what we were talking about, like Emma Stone and Lily Gladstone. It's like, both of them are so good. Both performances are going to go down. And it was like a thing like that where it's just like, yeah, it's Citizen Kane, but also this is a really fucking good movie. So maybe it didn't steal it.
Gotcha.
That's some of the stuff that I've heard, but would you agree with that or no?
Yes, I would. It's very, very good. I'm just trying to look for what are the other nominations that year? That was 42, right? The list here. Why do they have it at the bottom? Or do they? 14th Academy Awards. John Ford won his third Best Director award for How Green Was My Valley. He must have won for, oh yes, The Grapes of Wrath in 1940. And of course, the big one, the South movie, Wind.
John Ford?
Didn't John Ford do...
Absolutely not. He did not direct John with the Wind.
Not with the Wind, no. Okay. Second to do so. John Ford won his third Best Director for How Green Was My Valley. So that one. Other nominated movies were Blossoms in the Dust, Here Comes Mr. Jordan, Hold Back the Dawn, The Little Foxes, The Maltese Falcon. So I'd probably say that was third. One Foot in Heaven, Sergeant York, and Suspicion by Alfred Hitchcock. So to answer your question, I've heard of Suspicion, Maltese Falcon, Citizen Kane, and How Green Was My Valley. So, you know, out of those four, I'd say Citizen Kane probably should have won it. And then if there's a second place one, probably Maltese Falcon, just because I'm...
Yeah, Maltese Falcon's really fucking good.
It is very
good. Not gonna lie, it's a good fucking movie. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, but it's a good fucking movie.
Yeah, and just to talk about How Green Was My Valley, just, you know, it was about a mining family in South Wales Valley during the late Victorian era. So it was a lot of that kind of stuff where other villages are shutting down, other operations are shutting down, and they have to bring the citizens there. And they're, you know, obviously overwhelmed with too many citizens, not enough jobs for the people there. I don't know. It was one of those just like the guy, one guy speaking out against it and everyone else is telling him to shut the fuck up. Because everyone goes on strike and everyone's pissed off. And then the patriarch of the main family is against the strike, against unionization. So it was just another one of those like Frank Capra guys. We're all people. Let's just, you know, both sides are kind of shitty. Let's just sing a song around the fire while we can, sort of thing. So, yeah. It was fine.
And real fast, just want to say Victor Fleming, guy who directed Gone with the Wind. Victor Fleming, who same year he directed The Wizard of Oz. That is insane. He directed both those movies in the same year. He did beat out John Ford that year for Best Picture and then also for Best Director. He was nominated for Gone with the Wind because I guess you can only be nominated twice. He beat him for John Ford was nominated for Stagecoach, as was your boy that you just mentioned, Frank Capra, for Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, a movie most people like and I despise.
You despise. Yeah. For, I'm guessing, the same reasons I was just mentioning, just very... very, what do you call that? The Aaron Sorkin school of like, maybe we'll just say the right thing and things will be fine.
Yeah, exactly. That whole chestnut.
One I really did like because it's something that I just came across, you know, doing the Best Picture Marathon, Mrs. Miniver. Actually very interesting because I don't know if I texted you about this, but it's like a prequel. It takes place in the World War II movie universe because a lot of these people – we're getting into 42 now, so 41, 42, 43, 44, obviously, World War II, and movies are starting to comment on it. And it actually commented on Dunkirk pretty quickly and with pretty astute vision there. It's basically about – a middle-class family that's living in England. So it's getting swept up in World War II. His son has to join the British RAF, the Air Force. This is William Wyler. So, you know, a great writer, great director, you know, Ben-Hur, Best Years of Our Lives, which I think is one of the next ones up. You know, The Heiress, Funny Girl, all that kind of stuff. Very, very good. Well, really well written, very well acted. Greer Garson, who I wrote about her in my review. Let me see if I can find it real quick. I really liked it. I think I have it ranked number 6 so far out of the 18 that I've seen. We have Greer Garson, who I was not familiar with before watching this movie. She was the 4th most nominated actress with 7, and she has five consecutive nominations, which ties Bette Davis. She won for this film, which is definitely deserved. Actually one of my favorites I've seen so far in this marathon.
Okay, very nice. You're burning through these things.
Not really. I'm only on 18. I think I started. Didn't I start like in January, February? I still have the majority. I haven't, just for posterity, I haven't seen. I haven't seen more than half of them. So I actually have a long way to go. I'm still in.
Oh, 18. I mean, like, you know, for people like us that watch like a movie a day, it's like, oh, only 18. But that's pretty respectable.
Yes, I'm getting there. I'm knocking them out. Let me see. We got The Lost Weekend, which I ranked number 5. So a little above Mrs. Miniver. It's very good. It's, I think I talked about this before, of these, some of these movies now finally not being an epic, not being a war epic, not being about neoliberal capitalism. It's just about a guy who's just alcoholic and trying to hide it from his friends and family and his girlfriend or whoever is, you know, battling with him. And very, very good. Ray Millens gives a very good, melodramatic performance, but I said it's melodramatic, but very controlled. It could have easily veered into the realm of like method acting, even though it had been employed for another 10 years. Jane Wyman, who was in Douglas Sirk's 1955, All That Heaven Allows, is very, very good in here. She plays Helen. The woman is trying to help him kick his alcoholism. Very, very good. Very good movie. Yep.
Definitely nice. Yeah, it's one of Billy Wilder's early ones. It's a Wilder I actually haven't seen yet. Billy Wilder, you know, maybe probably my favorite screenwriter of all time. You know, great director as well, of course. So this is I think this is the only time. No, he won for the apartment one too. So never mind. Yeah. Scratch that. But yeah, an early Wilder win for sure.
Yeah, very early, 45. Yep, very, very good. Highly recommend checking that out. That does it for my Best Picture marathon so far. I'm up to, like I said, 1945. I haven't seen many of those in the 40s or the 50s. Let me check my list, actually. I have a couple of different lists. You can check me out on Letterboxd. I'll just mention that right now. I've just I went through and I followed a bunch of people. And I'm up to 515 followers. Follow me on Midnight Film Pod on Letterboxd over there. All Best Picture winners. So I'm up to, like I said, The Lost Weekend from 1945. Next up is The Best Years of Our Lives. Like I said, already directed by William Wyler. Should be pretty good. Then rest of the 40s are Gentleman's Agreement, which I looked this up and I was like, what is that even about? A magazine writer poses as a Jew to expose anti-Semitism. So this is, 1947, so they've obviously discovered what was going on there. Got out there, and so it's leaking into some of the movies back then. 1948's Hamlet, 1949's All the King's Men rounds out to the 40s. So definitely getting to some more interesting stuff with All About Eve and American in Paris coming up.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's interesting to see how these, Best Picture winners go, because I feel like a lot of time they'll be like you talk about, like these early ones, they're all like these movies about like economic struggles and stuff like that, and that's because that's like the trendy thing, or to like the social commentary that's the Academy wants to be like, yes, we recognize this, and then there becomes war movies and epics and stuff like that, and the decades you're gonna get into, and then how until like the 90s and 2000s it's gonna be like, oh, racism was bad, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm really not looking forward to Traffic and Crash. Crash.
Traffic? You mean Driving Miss Daisy?
No, Traffic. Didn't Traffic win? I'm thinking of a different one. Traffic was like the same year. There's a couple of them that were just like, oh boy, that's not.
It's Steven Soderbergh. So, yeah. But I did not win Best Picture, I don't think.
No, it didn't. That was
I think you're thinking of, you're just thinking of Crash again.
Yes. It doesn't look great. Who did Crash? Crash was Mr. Paul Haggis. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm not looking forward to that. And I'm not looking forward to Shakespeare in Love. Yeah, a lot of, going back to the war epics with, you know, stuff like English Patient, Braveheart, Dances of the Wolves, Last Emperor, Out of Africa. Yeah, just like, I think if there's more than anything, there's, it's about war. Patent, what else? Not sure, it's a fire. Gandhi, Deer Hunter, Platoon. Man, yeah, I would say if you were to...
There's a lot of fucking Vietnam movies, I feel like.
Yes and no. There's... What is there? Deer Hunter. There's... Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, from that decade, yes. But I don't know about that. Well, actually, yeah, you're right. Platoon and Deer Hunter both won. Yeah. A lot of war. It's just like, Jesus Christ. So let's go back to you, stuff you've been watching. You, you know, the funny story about this is last time I was railing against, like, people, come on, just see movies. Get good. Get good at seeing movies. Get good at finding movies. They're out there. You can find them. Most of the time, they're available. And today, you're going to talk about two movies you've seen that I haven't because they're not playing near me. So tell me about Rose Glass's second feature, Love Lies Bleeding.
Yeah, so I did manage to see a couple movies that unfortunately are not playing near you because I live out here where there's culture.
There's culture.
And where we appreciate movies about lesbians and murder, which were, on a surface level, what the themes of both of these movies were. But yeah, Love Lies Bleeding. It's one of those movies I'm like, you're watching it and you're thinking, this is either a masterpiece or it's complete garbage. Like, I feel like this could be this year's Saltburn. You know what I mean? Where people are like, it's so good. Or it's, you know, it's set in like the, I think, late 80s. Cause I think, or maybe early 90s. I guess it would be, like 89 or 90. Cause they mentioned Die Hard having just come out recently. But it is one of those movies that is subtly pretty surreal. Like, it's got its surrealist elements that slowly kind of creep in, and then kind of at the end you're like, oh shit, all right, yeah, this has got some weird shit in it. Really great just lesbian crime movie that is really fucking dark. Very dark comedy. I feel like the whole second act just kind of loses the comedy. But the third act, it kind of comes back, and it's one of those movies you're like watching into the theater, and like people are laughing uncomfortably, and people like I'll say, you know, something you would say usually, the normies, they're just like, what is happening here? I liked it a lot, you know. Everybody in this is really phenomenal. You know, obviously you have Kristen Stewart in this just giving a fucking great performance, you know, just doing her just like awkward like thing that she does, and you know, she's great in it. She's Katie O'Brien playing her love interest. You know, she's somebody who people might recognize as the buff girl from Ant-Man and the Wasp. Ed Harris, Jenna Malone, Dave Franco, basically playing his brother. It's pretty great. I was watching, I was like, this is kind of phenomenal. This is a trip. And I looked up Rose Glass afterward. I didn't get a chance to see Saint Maud, but I got really depressed because Rose Glass, who's now, this is her second movie, it's absolutely incredible, is the same age as me. And that made me very sad.
Love Lies Bleeding. A lot of people are comparing it to Bound. I know you like the Wachowskis.
Yeah, that's the only Wachowskis I haven't seen, and I've been meaning to for so long. I've just not gotten around to it. A movie that people are like, you know, when it came out, they're like, wow, these two straight dudes really know a lot about lesbians. And then like 10 years later, they're like, everyone's like, oh, okay, yep, that checks out. Oh my god, everything in the Matrix makes so much sense now.
Yeah, I was going to say, oh, you're talking about Rose Glass earlier. And one of my favorite directors, you know, new directors, you were saying how she's your same age. Really liked St. Maud. Had a very, like, call it abrupt ending, I would say. How is, just not to spoil anything, but just talk in generalities. How does the ending of this, is it abrupt? Is it weird?
It's weird. It's not abrupt. It's one of those movies you're watching, and you're like, what is going to happen? Like most movies, 98% of movies you watch, and like, all right, I know what is going to happen. I just don't know how they're going to get there. You know, you understand that they're going to throw the ring into the volcano and Sauron will be destroyed, or that like they're going to find Nemo, you know, like you get that. Yeah. Right. But with this movie, I'm just like, this could go any number of ways. And I have no idea. And then when it does go the way it goes, you're like, okay, that's interesting. It's weird. And like I said, it gets the most surreal towards the end. And it's a thing where like the surrealism kind of just creeps up on you. And if you're watching closely like me, you're noticing it. But if you're not paying attention, you might be like, what, at the end? But so I appreciated it a lot.
Nice. Yeah, I really want to check that out.
Yeah. And one final thought I just want to say on Love Lies Bleeding. And that is, I don't know what this says about me, but the gayer that Kristen Stewart looks, the more I am attracted to her. Like, that's all I'll say.
Amazing. Awesome. All right. And you also checked out the other sapphic romance this week. Miss Margot Qualley in, let me see.
Driveaway Dolls.
Driveaway Dolls. And the person, the director of it is Ethan, not Joel Cohen, Ethan Cohen.
Yes. Yes. So yeah, this is the, you know, the Cohen brothers. So, I think, yeah, Ethan is usually the one who's a little more, I think like he's the one who kind of gets credited with a little more stuff. You know, he did Macbeth solo last year. So yeah, this was kind of like, all right, well, what's the other Coen brother doing? And I know this one is getting somewhat mixed reviews, but I also found this one phenomenal. I thought it was just really quirky in a way that felt reminiscent of some of the more fun, upbeat Coen brothers movies. I think that, you know, it's just a kind of like a madcap, you know, just kind of farce of, you know, once again, lesbians in the late 20th century with a dead body. And, you know, there's like a MacGuffin and you're like, what is it? And it's like, are they just going to cop out? Like, and then when the reveal of the MacGuffin happens, it's one of the funniest things I've seen in a movie, at least the last couple of years. It's great. There's a lot of chemistry between the stars of this movie. Of course, you mentioned Margaret Qualley, and then there's I'm gonna maybe butcher this, Geraldine Viswanatha, who's I haven't really seen her in that much stuff before. She's great.
Yeah.
She was really awesome. And then, you know, you've got, you know, other people. It's got just, you know how the Coens always have, like, weird characters? Oh, yeah. Just,
yeah,
there's a lot of that in this movie.
Nice.
You know, there's, you know, Coleman Domingo shows up in this. He's great. You've got, of course, Pedro Pascal, who's only in really the opening scene. But he's just doing some facial stuff, you know, that is facial, is incredible. Okay.
You had the Pedro Pascal facial.
Yeah. wait till you see the stuff that they do with Matt Damon. Oh, Matt, shit. You think the facial with Pedro Pascal is good? Just wait till the body parts of Matt Damon start flying around. But Damon's great. You know, Damon who is he loves to be like the thankless, just like guy who shows up in the third act of a movie
and just is
kind
of
a buffoon. Oh, absolutely. You need somebody to show up at the end of your movie, surprise Damon. It's always great. And I think I guess this, like, you know, he was like in some of the trailers and stuff, but I didn't know he was in this. So I was kind of surprised. Like you see him on a billboard before you actually see him. I was like, is that Matt fucking Damon? And then he shows up and yeah, this is a lot of fun, man. This is just a good madcap comedy.
Yeah. I think, Margot Qualley might be my favorite actress working right now.
Wow.
You know, you and I, yeah, well, younger, maybe like 30 under 30, if you get the list out, maybe her and who else, you know, the Dune folks, probably some of my favorites. Okay. But just in terms of like the stuff she chooses to do, we obviously know her from Leftovers. She was amazing in that series. The stuff I've seen her in, Stars at Noon was a very interesting Claire Denis sort of noir, neo-noir with her in it. What else was she in?
Sanctuary. She was just in Poor Things.
Like not briefly, but like as the other, the other experiment. Yeah, that was very interesting. Mm-hmm. She was in the movie I saw recently called Sanctuary. Yeah, she always, every time she pops up, I'm like, I have no idea what kind of performance we're going to get out of her. She was Pussycat in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. You know, her and her dirty feet in the car. That was her feet. Yeah. Her and her feet were in that. Very, very cool.
The Nice Guys. She's nice really guys. Great in The Nice Guys.
Yes. There was something else I saw her in. I was like, oh, man.
She's Death so... Note. The American Death Note.
Apparently she was in that. I scrolled past that.
It's a terrible movie.
Mia Sutton.
Like, everybody in it is good, but she, like, or not everybody. Nat Wolff isn't great, but, like, she's really good. Like, Keith Stanfield and her and Jay Wiggum. And of course, Defoe are good in it, but it's a bad movie.
Okay. Speaking of a possibly bad movie, tell me about Dune 1984. You've been on a Dune kick, huh? Since the last time?
Oh yeah, I have. Yeah. So both my last couple of things were like, you know, I was thinking a lot about Dune, and you know, about sandworms and all that stuff. So I watched a couple Dune adjacent things. I had never seen the original Dune, and I wanted to hold off until Dune Part 2 because I didn't want to spoil the good Dune with the old one.
Yes.
And yeah, this movie is insanity. This movie is bad. It's weird because it's like you're watching, you're like, this is the same story, but just done in a way that kind of truncates everything, that makes things... basically make no sense. Like, if I hadn't seen the other Dune before this, I'd be like, what is even happening?
Right.
Have you seen this version?
I have not. This is one of the few Dune things I haven't engaged with yet.
It's wild. Like, I love Sting, and Sting is having the time of his life, but he is not good in this. He's just like, kill me! Ah! Like, it's bizarre. There's a lot of just, like, you know, like, Paul just shows up and is like, he's just the Fremen, like, because they're like, we've got 45 minutes of movie left. We've got to do the whole plot of Dune 2 now. All right, he's the Fremen savior. Why? Just is. That's the reason, you know? It rains at the end. It is wild. It is, there's like a whole scene where the sandworms come out and like serenade them in the desert or something. I don't know what was really happening there.
Yeah.
The worms are spice and the spice is worms. He says the thing. He says the thing from the Christopher Walken video. He says... which I'm sure is obviously from the book, but like hearing it, like, just kind of like took me out for a second. It was just like, it's walk without rhythm and you won't attract the worm. And I was like hearing Kyle MacLachlan say that with a straight face. I was like, wait a minute. So yeah, weird. It's just, and they're like, it looks bad, right? It looks terrible. And you're watching it for a second, you're like, okay, I get it. It's dated. You know, they did what they could at the time. But then you remember, like, no, this came out, like, after Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
Like, have you seen the force field scene?
Yes. Yeah, like, blocky. It looks like
yeah, it people. Looks like Roblox. It's insanity. Yes. It's like, you know, like, Pat, like, people are good in it. There's, like, I get why it's a cult classic and people like it, but, like, David Lynch has disowned it. You know, he refuses to do, like, a longer cut because he just says, like, yeah, it would be longer and the story makes sense, but it still wouldn't be a good movie. Yeah. And, like, going back to the special effects, like, I think that's Dino De Laurentiis cutting corners, because originally, like, John Dykstra, who ran ILM before ILM was, like, ILM, back when it was, like, you know, getting formed to basically be to create the special effects for Star Wars, he was the guy who ran it, won a special effect for Star Wars, has done plenty of great special effects work. Lucas didn't choose to utilize him because I guess they butted heads a lot. It's in the ILM documentary that's on Disney Plus. It's really interesting. But he went and started his own studio when he didn't get used in ILM. They were going to go with John Dykstra, and then I guess for cost-cutting measures or something, they didn't, and it shows. This movie looks real bad.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. I do have to check it out. You know, I've read the books, seen both the movies. Yeah, I definitely, that's got to be in my list. And just finish it out with Jodorowsky's Dune, the documentary about Mr. Jodorowsky's trying to make Dune.
Yeah, got to catch my breath here. But yeah, okay. This movie, you know, because I actually watched this one right before I watched the 1984 Dune, because, you know, it's interesting because having seen someone actually do the story justice, I was really interested. It's like, you know, because this movie was supposed to be unfilmable. It's like the Alien 3 thing where it kept changing hands and different directors and different writers. And this movie, Jodorowsky's Dune, that chronicled, you know, his attempts, this insane person, Jodorowsky, who's made all these like bizarre movies with like golden shit and stuff in them. His Dune was going to be like, he's like insane. He's a crazy person. There's a scene in it where he talks about how he's raping Frank Herbert. And like, you're like, okay, like fucking what? And yeah, his Dune was apparently going to have Salvador Dali as the emperor. And like, it's interesting. Cause like, he got all these really creative people together and did a lot of really cool stuff. It like the Lynch version would have just made Paul just like a messiah, but like even more so. Like he would have been like he would have apparently died at the end, and like that would have made peace in the universe, something like that. It seemed insane. It seemed like very bad, and like there's people in it like fucking what's his name who directed Drive who were like, it would have been incredible, I saw like his storyboards, and you're like, dude, this movie looks like insanity. Like I don't think it would have been good at all, but it would have been fucking interesting. And that's kind of how the Lynch one was, but like,
yes,
yeah, I love movies about like the process of movies getting made, and like the behind the scenes stuff. It's like the Abed quote from Community. He's like, Hearts of Darkness is way more interesting than Apocalypse Now. And you know, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, but like, he's hidden some truth there, right? And the story of like this crazy film almost getting made, and the highs and lows of that process, and him recruiting people like H.R. Geiger to like design the Harkonnen planets and stuff like that. And a lot of the people who worked on this eventually would go and work on Alien. It's really fascinating because the DNA of this movie would inform the next 10 years of sci-fi movies, even though this movie doesn't even exist.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, people read it. That's where all those influences came from reading the books, obviously.
Yeah, but I mean, even stuff that's like, you know, it's explicitly not like the H.R. Geiger stuff, you know, like his like designs of the Harkonnen planet, which were not like explicitly not in the book, did like influence like his view on Alien. The screenwriter who worked on this went on to work with him on Alien and other projects and stuff like that. So yeah, it's very fascinating. It's a really interesting, if you are like me, curious about the processes of movies getting made, adaptations of these big unfilmable projects, it's worth checking out for sure.
Nice, very cool.
I need to take a break. I need to take a breath. That's why we switch off usually.
We usually do, yes. let's see. So Fear City is a movie I heard about from the Letterboxd crew when they asked one of the people from Anatomy of a Fall, I think the actor that played the son, they asked him his, you know, one of his four favorites, and he was like, can it be in a French movie? And he's like, yeah, we, you know, we prefer that actually. And he's like, yeah, this so Fear City. It's a movie called let me see the actual actual name of it. La Cité de la Peur. Yes, the City of Fear. Yes.
Croissant.
It's what's the freaking movie called? Naked Gun. It's that. The Frenchman in Naked Gun.
Okay.
Yeah, that's literally it. Just like dumb pun jokes, you know, dumb wiener jokes. it's that. It's super campy, super over the top, you know, but it has a very serious, you know, straight man cop at the center of it, starring Alain Chabat, yes. A bunch of people I'd never heard of before, but yeah. 93 minute, very funny French movie. So recommend checking that out. That's on, I think on Canopy. I think that's where I saw that one. I've been finding a few things on Canopy recently that were pretty good.
Canopy is like if people don't know, Canopy is a streaming service that you just need a library card to access, and it has so much good shit, like Past Lives is on there.
Yeah, a lot of recent stuff. A lot of stuff you can't really find anywhere else. I saw which one did I not actually talk about? One of those I have in the list of existential dreary movies, like Drive My Car. Let's see if I pull it up real quick. What did I even call it? I called it like meditative cinema. Let me just find a list real quick. First page. Not sure where we went, but it was a movie by Hong Sang-soo, it was a movie called On the Beach at Night Alone. Now, the question is, why did I bring that up?
That was a good question.
We were talking about Fear City. We were talking about movies that I'm just kind of watching. Foreign movies. Oh, for the Canopy. Yes, Canopy had...
Right.
Yes, Canopy had the movie on the Beach at Night Alone by Hong Sang-soo. Very meditative movie. Very, very Drive My Car. If you like Drive My Car, definitely recommend checking that out. What else we got? Something we've both been watching. Are you caught up on Shogun, by the way?
Seen all four episodes.
So the fifth one comes out like the 19th. I looked that up. there are four in. I believe it's a 6-part series, I believe is what they said. Maybe.
I have to double check. Yeah.
Yeah. Stars your guy, Hiroyuki Sanada.
Yeah.
And some guy I love his acting in this, love his character.
Oh, so it's 10 parts, by the way. 10 parts.
Thank you. Yeah. Somebody I was never really familiar with up until now. Speaking of people younger than us doing amazing work, we got Cosmo Jarvis as
I will go and find the Japans for you.
The Japans.
He's just not such a distinct way of speaking.
He does.
I really like this guy. I hadn't seen him before in anything, but he's pretty great.
It's like a more gruff, more manly, more energetic Daniel Plainview. I drink milkshake. It's sort of like that. Sort of got that cadence to it.
You bastard. You've got my guns on that ship.
I love how he just like grumbles away. Like they're telling him to bathe and he's like, fuck off. Fucking die. We'll stick if I want to stick.
I've already bathed once this week.
He's like, what did he call it? It was something that would eventually be known as like scurvy or something. He's like, do you want me to catch the pox or whatever the fuck it's called?
Oh, yeah.
What was I going to say about this? Yeah, very good looking show. Very expensive show. Like I said, really well acted, really well shot. A lot of notable characters. So that's the type of thing they did. I think I mentioned this when you were like, yeah, you should watch this. And I was like, no, I got my Edo period. Fill with Blue Eye Samurai, I think it's 100 years before that takes place. It's got
1600.
Yeah, themes that they probably saw in the movie like Silence. Similar ideas through this, Portuguese Catholics coming over, and what are they doing?
Nestor Cabanel from Lost coming over they're basically monopolizing like the trade and also trying to extend Christianity to all parts of the world. And it's like they talked about it, I think, in the second or third episode, how the backstory is you know, once the quote-unquote New World was discovered, Spain and Portugal divided it up and said, after this line, the top part is yours, the bottom part is ours.
Yeah.
And then they were like, 20 years later, they were like, you know, that went really well. Let's do that on, like, the other side of the world, too, with, like, Asia. We'll just chop, like, the world in half and say, all right, this half is yours, Portugal. This bottom half is ours, Spain. So that's, you know, basically just colonizers.
Yeah, I guess my question is just like, what do they have to offer at that point? Like, the way you're saying is like, okay, they're opening up trade routes, right? They're controlling the trade routes. They're bringing them things that they need. But like, the first time a white dude shows up on their shore, why not just murder them? Like, why are they even humoring these people?
Well, it's not like the people in Japan weren't familiar with like the concept of white people, you know, like, you know, this Marco Polo and Silk Roads had been going on for hundreds of years. I know that's to China, but I mean, Vikings didn't make it to Japan, but
there was trade, there was things going on. Yeah, they were I understand they were noting, they know the concept of a Eastern European person, but because they're just there and they're just taking up space. And I'm just wondering, like you said, from an economics point of view, why are they putting up with their bullshit at all? Because the Christians or the Catholics are saying, like, we're going to bring you the, what are they bringing them? I don't understand, like, the value of having.
Well, like, some of them have already, like, converted. Like, two of the lords are already Christian, you know?
Okay, yeah. And
And it's like, you know, it's a lot. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, and that's why, of course, like, you know, that's what Silence covers is, like, them being like a couple decades later being like, you know what, how about you don't bring Christianity over here? And maybe going a little too hardcore with that, you know, just gonna say, you know, not a great response, but you know, but also, like, you know, forcing your religion on the people in the first place, not great. Also, yeah, it's interesting, it's a weird, interesting, complex situation. And you know, how, you know, even though they're like, you know, we mentioned Cosmo Jarvis is Blackthorn. He's a Protestant, so he hates the Catholics, and has been like maybe doing war crimes against them. So you know, it's an enemy of my enemy is my friend type thing. So yeah, I don't know. It's fucking tight though. It's such a good show. It's Game of Thrones shit, you know.
Yeah,
but real. It's like Game of Thrones, but like the real world.
Yeah, slight spoilers for the end of episode 4, but like, you know, horse trunks flying everywhere. That was pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh my god. I was like, what the fuck? What that happened?
Yeah, cannons fuck shit up. They absolutely do.
Yeah. Yep.
So yeah, very good show. Highly recommend that.
I guess that's part of the reason too. Like getting artillery and guns and things like that.
Yeah. Yes. What was I gonna say? Very good show. How much you get week to week? Very good.
Yeah.
Let's see. I got Waterworld. You assigned me Waterworld for losing the Oscar pool. I watched this today. I actually really liked it. I wasn't expecting, like, I think the runtime helped out a lot. When I looked it up last time, I mentioned it only being a little bit over 2 hours. So I think that helped a lot of moving the plot along. Very, very fun, like swashbuckling action, you know, call back to all that sort of thing and practical effects. And, you know, the thing about practical effects is they can look good and they make you feel like the person's there or whatever, but it's always
like, wow, Kevin Costner is drinking his own piss.
It's a still suits before still suits. the thing about practical effects is if you are, you know, if you're eagle-eyed enough, let's say, to look for, like, you kind of know what things look like in the real world. So when you see, like, a colander in somebody's head that's just painted to look like a helmet, you're like, that's kind of chintzy. I understand using practical effects is cool almost all the time, but there are certain points where you're just like, all right, well, that's just, it's clearly a boat. that's clearly a jet ski that you just put a bunch of barnacles on to make it look like it's part of that world. But the action set pieces were very good, very cool. It's very funny to see this after being to Florida, going to Disney World, you know, quite a few times and seeing the theme park version of this done first. And then it's like, yeah.
Universal Studios, by the way.
Yeah, Universal Studios. Yeah, the first time seeing that, then
the Stunt Spectacular.
The Stunt Spectacular. And basically seeing the one for one. It was like a recreation of the beginning of this movie. Have you seen this movie, by the way, that you assigned me?
I have, yes. Yes, okay. I have seen this one. I watched all the Mad Max movies. Yeah. Then I ran out, like, with at least the first three. And then I was like, well, I guess I'll watch Waterworld now. Me and my friend were binging them during lockdown.
Yeah, it is that. You know, it's Mad Max on water. I think they talked about this when they were making it. Mm. It's very interesting. I was looking up the making of this, and one of these guys whose names pops up, like war criminals, speaking of war criminals, his name pops up a lot. He didn't do war crimes, but he was kind of a piece of shit. What piece of shit is known for punching up scripts, being a script doctor, but then going on to make very quippy things. He's known as the quippy guy in action movies, in superhero movies. He was known for putting his DNA into that.
Oh, Avi Arad?
No, Josh Whedon. Josh Whedon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I forgot he did do a pass on this.
Yes, did a pass on this. That said he didn't enjoy his experience, but it's, I don't know, it's one of those things where you hear about that and you're like, oh, okay, you can pick up on these quips where, like, when Costner's near the beginning, when they're attacking that first atoll or platform, whatever they're on, and Costner is in the cage and the cage gets knocked into the sinking pool or whatever, the quicksand or whatever, and he's trying to get out and he breaks the thing and he just barely gets his head above the thing, and the woman comes over and she's like, if I get you out of here, will you take us with you? And he's like, sure. It was one of those where you're just like, okay, this, I noticed the DNA, the Whedon DNA of having somebody say something funny in an action set piece. But yeah, Jean Triplehorn, I haven't seen her in very much. She was very good in this. Yeah. Do you know what the child actor was in? What she would go on to be in? Margarino. Tina Margarino played, nope,
idea.
The girl. 2003, very low budget movie. I talked about. It was like the Foot Fist Way. It felt like it had that sort of humor and also the same budget as this movie.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And I just, when I wanted to assign you something that, you know, like I put it beforehand, I was like, this is somehow both unwatchable schlock and also like a prestige masterpiece, you know, like it somehow occupies both spaces.
Yes.
And it's just like this insane boondoggle that, you know, Kevin Costner made, and, you know, this huge vanity project, and it's a movie that I'm like, I don't want to give you just something like that's you're not going to enjoy at all, but it's not going to be one you're going to choose to watch. You know, it's got to be kind of insane and it's got to be kind of schlock. So I'm glad you had fun with it.
Yeah, I really did. And just to clarify, the Napoleon Dynamite was the movie I was thinking of that Tina Majaro was in. She would go on to be Deb in.
Oh, yeah. I knew that. Okay, her, because she's also, I forgot that's her. Because she, yes. She's also on Veronica Mars.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I totally forgot that was her. It's been a couple years since I've seen this movie.
Yeah, it was very good. You know, Dennis Hopper is chewing the fuck out of the scenery.
He's so good, and he, like, loves, and he, like, and it's one of those things, it's like, it's a very, like, you're like, it's a flag that when this movie came out, because it's, he's like, this guy, he's our patron saint or whatever the fuck. And you're like, who is that? You look it up and it's like, oh, it was the captain of the Exxon Valdez. Okay. Like, that's such a topical, like, thing that would only, like, be a reference that 90s people would understand.
Exactly. That's hilarious. So, yeah, Waterworld. Worth the watch, I would say.
Nice.
Yeah. So yeah, that's pretty much everything we've been watching. Going on to Letterboxd assignments this week, I actually did watch my assignment and it was very good. I've been on a good kick lately of good movies,
nice.
From back in the day. Failsafe was my assignment, directed by obviously Mr. Sidney Lumet, like I mentioned last time, from 1964. This stars Mr. Henry Fonda as the president. I thought it was interesting. They literally just call him Mr. President. They never actually say his name. You have Dan O'Harely. I'm not sure what he was in. And a very young Walter Matthau is in this as well. Playing like a... he was basically... You know what role he fills in this movie that I think Jeff Goldblum was go on to sort of emulate a little bit. Or I'm wondering if, you know, the character was written for him like that, or based on Walter Matthau's character, because he's like this philosophical guy, not a doctor of philosophy, but like, you know, military cachet from, you know, working for them but not really under them, you know what I mean? So he was the guy who was like, we can't kill, you know, or we have to kill 2 million people because we fucked up and bombed Russia. spoiler a little bit for this movie. There's some major stuff that happens in this movie, but the premise is so they're just in the war room. They're in, it's a very serious version of Dr. Strangelove. So it's they're doing this missile test, or they're testing the radar, testing the missile's radar. This is 1964, by the way, so it's very close to, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis and all of that stuff. That's why I wrote my review. So very timely stuff where they're talking about, you know, the fallibility of machines, and if a machine fucks up, what can we do? Can we stop it? You know, how much very ahead of its time in that thinking of, you know, are we, you know, have we already sealed our fate? Have we already sealed our destruction by, you know, building the bombs? You know, very Oppenheimer thing. But also, what are we going to do with the bombs? Who's controlling them? Who has, do we have full control of them? You know, the computers are, a lot of discussion about the computers, you know, the discretion of firing a missile could be at the computer's whim. You know, if the computer says you have to fire, do we fire? You know, a very, very famous story about a Russian who was told, who saw on his screen, just like in this movie, something on his radar that they thought was an incoming attack. And the operator was told to fire, and he said no. So very interesting.
Yeah, basically three guys that needed to turn the keys.
Yeah.
And one guy didn't, and probably saved the entire world and the human race, possibly. Yeah.
Probably, yeah. So this is a very good, like, two-hander. You know, it's pretty stat cast, but it's very much Henry Fonda and Larry Hagman, which most people will know Larry Hagman from Dallas and I Dreamed of Jeannie. Stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Very good in this as the interpreter for Henry Fonda. He's interpreting the Russians, and a lot of these scenes are just Larry Hagman and Henry Fonda, you know, just talking with the Russian premier, Russian president, and saying, "Hey, quick story, funny story. We have some missiles coming at you. We didn't mean to, and we're sorry, and sorry about that. But can we work out a deal here where you don't fire back? Is that possible?" So yeah, very good little taunt thriller. Very much enjoyed that.
Okay, interesting.
Yes, your assignment was Chungking Express from Mr. Wong Kar Wai, one of my favorite directors. Very moody, very vibes based, as the kids would say. This is your first time checking this out. What'd you think of it?
Yeah, this is, you know, I've only seen In the Mood for Love, which is one of my favorite films by him. So, you know, that's why this was on my watch list in the first place, is because I wanted to, you know, watch more of his stuff. And yeah, this, like that, is just this kind of, you know, very moody, as you said, vibes oriented. It's split into two stories. It's like two love stories. You know, both about these cops, and just kind of, in Hong Kong, and it's just very weird romance. It's one of those movies, it feels like it should be three parts, but I guess the third part he just made into, Fallen Angels, which is apparently also very good, but I guess it was just too long. So it's kind of weird, because it's like, there's like a short part at the beginning, and then a completely different longer story. Yeah. That is the second two thirds of the movie. But yeah, I like this a lot. You know, the Tony Leung, you know, who would be in The Mood for Love, was in this. So just kind of it's very, very funny. I watched this with my roommate and we were both cracking up. Just it's a delightful movie, is the best way to put it.
Yeah, very delightful. What'd you think of the needle drop I was mentioning last time?
Which needle drop are you talking about? The one that they just, because they played like five, they played like a couple songs like over and over and over.
Yeah. California Dreamin' by the Mamas and the Papas.
Yes, that was cool. And I was like, hey, I'm in California. That's cool. But yeah, because there's like a motif where they certain characters will play like one song many, many times. And that is one, there's this you know, this one of these characters who dreams of going to California. And so he kind of continually plays that song over and over. So
yeah,
kind of gets ingrained in your brain a little bit there, along with a couple other earworms in this movie.
Yes. Very, very good. Glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Let's see. So I'm going to go to my watch list for next time. Check out what we get. Pretty much put anything on there. I'm going to hit shuffle. And we get Goodbye Dragon Inn. This is this is similar to similar to Chungking Express, very vibes based, very contemplative, very meditative cinema, by Mr. Tsai Ming Liang. What did I see of his? Oh, he has this movie that I keep trying to turn on and watch, and it's just the like first 20 minutes is literally just a guy sitting in his room, just looking out into space, into the middle distance. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to sit down and watch this. It's 2 hours. I've heard it's very good. But yeah, my assignment is 2003 effort, Goodbye Dragon Inn. Let's see if this stars anybody we might know. Nope.
So it's just a guy looking out a window for 2 hours? It sounds right up your fucking alley,
Two 20 minutes. Yes, it is. So yeah, I'll be checking out, was it Goodbye Dragon Inn? That'll be next on my hit list. 82 minutes, very quick one.
That's always nice.
Yes. So, Derek, spin your wheel over there. Let me know what you got.
And I got, okay, interesting. The documentary Spielberg, which is, of course, a documentary about the life and career of one Mr. Steven Spielberg. So I was just talking about how much I love documentaries about making movies. So this should be fun.
Nice. What year did that come out, by the way?
That came out in 2017.
Okay, so got most of, yeah. I was going to say, he's
not Fablemans, but pretty much everything else. And I guess up to his Ready Player One, you know, where he peaked, of course.
I still haven't seen that movie. I'm probably not going to. It's
not a good movie.
Member berries.
It's not good. That's all it is, yeah.
That's what I've heard, yeah. All right, so you got that for next time. A bunch of stuff coming out in the next few weeks here. Next week we have The Three Body Problem on Netflix. I think I talked about here on the show about Three Body Problem, the series, the books, some of my favorite sci-fi, my favorite sci-fi of all time, really, just based on the conceits inherent in them, in the scale of it, in the themes of it, in the way he very accurately, I think, projects and speculates on how humans would actually react to an alien invasion, decades ahead of its time. It was first came out in 2006 in China, and it was only translated in 2014, 2015, 2016. So were translated fairly recently. I read through the three books three times. So again, this is another thing, another sci-fi translation, another sci-fi adaptation that I'm going to be like, well, actually, here's the thing. It'll be that guy again, but we'll see how that goes. You know, directed famously by, run by the Benioffs, or by the Benioffs, by the Davids, David Benioff, D.B. Weiss. So yeah, I've heard some things. I won't spoil it, but I've heard some things about it that people have seen it early release.
Okay.
So there's that.
All right.
Godzilla vs. Kong, The New Empire, the new one of these from Adam Wingard.
Is that already coming out? Fucking A, man.
Yep, about 2 weeks.
All right.
End of March, as far as I know. Actual release date of Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire is March 29th.
Gotta say the whole title.
Full title, please. March 29th, in the United States, which is, it's funny, it's coming out later in Japan, which is the reverse for their Godzilla movie. Their Godzilla versions.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. We also have Frida, a documentary from director Carla Gutierrez, who did the editing on the RPG doc from 2018. That's an Amazon release. We got Roadhouse coming at you. Roadhouse. this is the Doug Liman Roadhouse coming out pretty soon here, debuting on Amazon Prime. What do they say? Yeah, March 21st. Did you hear about this? The controversy around this is that Doug Liman was told that if he takes a pay, if he takes a budget cut, this was supposed to be $30 million. I think they negotiated him down to 20, and they said, you know, in return for the distributor or the company MGM, I think originally said this. They said, okay, listen, in addition or in exchange for you accepting less budget, we are going to release this in theaters. There will be no shenanigans. And then they reneged on their deal, apparently. So, yeah.
Well, that is not great.
Doug Liman directing, obviously no stranger to action. The Bourne Identity, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, mm-hmm. Jumper, Edge of Tomorrow. So, yeah, should be pretty cool.
Pretty cool, pretty cool. Taylor Swift fans are not excited, but everyone else is.
Why is that? Do I want to know?
she used to date her. There's a whole thing where he had, maybe has sweat, her scarf.
The scarf, yes. Yeah. Okay, all right, gotcha. Good pull there.
Thank you.
We got...
And it's one of those things that's like, I was like, do we need a Roadhouse remake? And then I saw the trailer. I was like, I kind of love JKG. This looks good.
Yeah, in addition to Godzilla, X-Con, the new empire, we have Ghostbusters, the Frozen Empire. Different empire. I'm assuming no crossover there.
Yeah, it's like Persia and Rome. They might have existed at the same time, but
exactly. You know, Carrie Coon is a very interesting actress. She had a video or like something go viral where she was talking about how her husband has, you know, 10,000 DVDs and she's not allowed to rent anything or stream anything because it's the sanctity of the blacks, the sanctity of the colors on there, the color, whatever. Carrie, do you know who Carrie Coon's husband is?
Tracy Letts.
Exactly. So yeah, celebrated stage actor, stage writer. Yeah. So that would be why, but no, she's, I flipped out when I found out she was the same person that was in, you know, The Leftovers, and she was also Approximate Midnight in Avengers Infinity War. It's just like...
Yeah, this is a fucking trip, right?
This is like the epitome of that, you know, one for them, one for me, except she just like, let me do this giant billion-dollar thing for them. Then I'm going to do The Nest. And then I'm going to do Ghostbusters Afterlife. And then I'm going to do, you know, the other thing. So... Very strange. Very strange.
She's the best. She is just, she's so good at like, and she's so good in both. Like, she's great in Endgame, or I guess Infinity War, and then she's also like, The Leftovers, phenomenal. One of the greatest performances on a TV show I've ever seen. You know.
Yep. We have Late Night with the Devil. This is a
whatever that is.
Shudder release. Debuted at the South by South Film Festival in March. It is a. One of the first David Desmashian-led movies. So the premise is, presented in a found footage style, David Desmashian stars as Jack Delroy, the host of a fictional 1970s variety and late-night talk show entitled Night Owls with Jack Delroy. The film purports to be derived from a rediscovered master tape of an episode from the show's sixth season broadcast on Halloween 1977. During the live television broadcast, havoc unfolds when Delroy interviews a parapsychologist, Laura Gordon, and the subject of her recent book, a young teenager was a sole survivor of a satanic church's mass suicide. So, there we go. That's really released on March 22nd and be available on Shudder in April. We also have another horror movie with Sydney Sweeney. Apparently, she's been trying to make this for 10 years. Seems like a passion project of hers called Immaculate. Went out to March 22nd. Okay. Put up by Neon. Those guys don't miss it, as they say.
Yeah. It looks like one of those horror movies that's going to be bad but a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah, and get it because it's immaculate conception, because, you know, she's maybe given birth, she's a nun, she gets pregnant, but it's also immaculate because Sydney Sweeney is a very pretty person. I don't know if you noticed.
Yes, she's very good looking. Good genes. Yeah. Good genes on that one. And finally, we have a movie from A24 called Problemista, directed, written by, produced by Julio Torres, who is known as the Chris Gethard Show, Saturday Night Live writer. So, yeah.
I thought this was Dimitri Martin. I thought it was like Dimitri Martin for the longest time.
Yeah. So there's that for next time. Looking forward to that. Plug time. I already mentioned it, but I'm just going to tear. It's very... Let me talk to you about this for a second, because this is like... All right. This is interesting. This is interesting to me, I think, because what I'm basically doing is artificially inflating my followers. I'm doing AstroTurf, that artificial, gaining a following. The AstroTurf being the opposite of a grassroots campaign. So I'm basically just going through and clicking, follow, and people are just following me back. So it's a very, very easy way of just sort of gaming the system, but not really, because I'm having to sit here and actually physically do a thing. So yeah. Anyways, I'm 87 away. That's all to say. I'm 87 away from 600 followers. So follow me at Midnight Film Pod on Letterboxd. Go to my Medium blog. I'm posting my any reviews that are lengthy and comprehensive on my Medium blog as well, as well as my Letterboxd. Go to Film Essayist on YouTube. You can actually sign up there for episodes as well, if you want to have that in the background in a YouTube channel for some reason.
Nice.
So you can go there and subscribe to that. It gets automatically updated from the RSS. Spotify for podcasters. Go check out everything from last year that I did on the feed. Derek, what do you got to plug?
Yeah. And so it's real fast. You said how many are you away from 600?
87.
87. Okay. I thought you said 67, because that's exactly how many followers I have.
yeah. Number go up, make me feel better. Yes, that's how it works.
I only follow on 52 people, though, so it's a good ratio. I'll just say that.
Yes.
Check out, of course, my podcast that I do, Underrated, which comes out every other Monday. So Mondays that this doesn't come out, Underrated comes out, where I talk about, of course, underrated, underappreciated, and under-the-radar films. Damien, as you mentioned, you've been on that show a couple times. Those episodes are always really fun. The episode that just came out last week was Walk Hard. Had a friend of the show, Austin Olivia Kendrick, back on to talk about one of my all-time favorite movies. And sticking with the musical theme, next Monday is going to be Sing Street. Had on Alex Marcus to talk about that one. So some really good stuff. You can also find my writing on places like Film Threat, where I write about independent films, doing reviews for them, and Watch Mojo, writing top 10 lists on films and a number of other subjects. And of course, I've got a Letterboxd too, much more humble than Damien's. You can follow me there, follow me on Medium and all the places. But yeah, Underrated Movie Podcast everywhere on all the socials. So just look that up.
Nice. Drive It Like You Stole It. Great song.
It fucking is. We spent 10 minutes just talking about how fucking great that song is.
Love it. All right. So with that, for Midnight Film Society Podcast, I've been Damien.
And I've been Derek.
And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.